Oh boy, it's just so exciting to be here in Albany, where I spent a lot of many a long and sometimes dreary day researching this book with the help of the archivists at the University at Albany, at the MySci, the GE Archive in Schenectady, at the Schenectady County Historical Society, in addition to the many other archives that I visited. And it's just so fun to come back at the end, and I'm sure many of you know what it feels like to be at the end of a project and come back and be like, oh, all that work was nothing. That was so fun. It was really great. And I did, in fact, learn the great value of snow tires while I was working on this book. I never had them on my car until I had to visit Albany regularly and do research, and it became absolutely imperative. So it's just so exciting. So the first thing that people always ask me about this book is, why did you write about the brothers Vonnegut? Like, what gave you the idea? You know, were you a big Kurt Vonnegut fan? Were you into the science? Did you somehow know something about weather control? And I always say, it was really about the Catskills. And I know that might be controversial with you Adirondack folks, and we were just up there in that beautiful Adirondack display, which makes me jealous because we don't have moose in the Catskills. But I have a cabin in Phoenicia in the Catskills, and I've been spending summers up there for a while. And I also happen to be a big fan of hydro infrastructure, which is probably very exciting to many of you too. I don't know how many hydro infrastructure buffs are in the room, but I think it's just, yes, yay! We'll talk. Since I love the Catskills and since I love hydro infrastructure, and my book Inventing Niagara is really about hydro infrastructure, because Niagara Falls is a big piece of hydro infrastructure, one of the best we have, I was reading a pretty dry but to me fascinating history of hydro infrastructure, New York City's reservoir system in the Catskills, and there was like a little sidebar, you know, where the historian puts like, I ran across this really cool thing in the archive, but I couldn't fit it into the narrative, so I just shoved it in this sidebar. And it was about this episode in 1950 where New York City cloud seeded the Catskills, because they were running out of water. And they hadn't yet built the final big, huge reservoirs in the Catskills. They only had a couple. And the population was growing. They just couldn't keep up. And 1949 and 50 were very dry years. And it literally got to the point where the New York Times was publishing on their front page a little box that said, days until water pressure fails, every day. And it would be like 26, you know, and New Yorkers were being encouraged, you know, to have shaveless Fridays and, you know, showerless Thursdays, and all the mayor stopped shaving just to sort of demonstrate how you could save water. They put the hippo in Central Park on rations. So seriously, Tiffany's, this is my favorite detail, Tiffany's put gin in the little fountain in their window display instead of water. So I loved that story, and I thought, why didn't I know anything about this? And then I found out that Bernard Vonnegut had invented the method by which the city had tried to create municipal rain, and I got fascinated by that, because I suddenly was just struck by this very lyrical image of two brothers, one trying to bring water and life down from the sky, and the other one kind of in a basement in Dresden with fire and death raining down on him, because of course Kurt had survived the firebombing of Dresden. And the more I dug into it, the better it got, you know, as a story. And it was, you know, it was a story about two brothers, and these two brothers were kind of at opposite ends of the spectrum, you might think. There's like the scientist and the artsy brother. There's the straight-A student and the class clown. There's the PhD chemist and the guy who kind of washed out of science classes at Cornell. So I was just really interested in this. There's the the guy who was recruited during the Second World War into the chemical warfare service, and the brother who got kicked out of the ROTC because he wrote a piece for the Cornell Sun about how when some supervisors came to inspect the ROTC troops, they had no idea what they were doing, the Cornell ROTC, so they ran around disassembling guns and yelling things like, "Flat Hatcher, Biffle Block," and acting like they were great soldiers. And the ROTC did not really like this story, and they threw him out. So, you know, this kind of contrast between these two brothers got better and better, and then I discovered that on February 14th, 1945, when Kurt was in the basement in Dresden with fire raining down on him, thinking he would probably not come out alive, Bernard Vonnegut was in the air in Minneapolis, Minnesota, at a place called the Ice Research Base, in a B-17 bomber plane, because he was studying aircraft de-icing so that he could help bombers get in and out of their missions in Europe. So that just tickled my story bone endlessly, and I immediately wanted to follow up on this. What happens after that, and I want to say what I'm doing in this talk tonight. I'm going to show you, I think it's around 25 slides, and I'm basically going to kind of give you what I think of as the illustrated top-line version of the first half of the book. So that's, and then, you know, I'll just leave you hanging there. That's my plan, my evil plan. Partly because I think I have a lot of people who know way more than I do in the audience about GE and about Albany Schenectady, and I think it's fun to see these images that I've collected from a bunch of archives, not just the ones here, but the Library of Congress, UPenn, and a number of other places, and happy to share all of that on a one-to-one basis. After the war, of course, Bernard Vonnegut went to work at the pioneering GE Industrial Research Lab, and this is usually the point where I go into a little explanation of how that's like Bell Labs and everything, but I think I probably don't need to do that here. I think people pretty much understand that this was an amazing job, that he was, you know, getting to the top of his field as a scientist, and I love this picture at the research lab of all the scientists at their office doors. Bernard is the second one there on the left. And I love how he's kind of peeking out of his office door with an impish grin, which he often had on his face. So he was really rocketing to the top of his field. Kurt, on the other hand, when he got back from the war, he wasn't quite sure what he was going to do with himself. He was floating a whole bunch of different ideas. I could go to law school. I could work in an office. I could be a teacher. I could be a screenwriter. He had all these various thoughts. The only thing he knew for sure was that he wanted to marry Jane Cox, which he promptly did, pretty much the minute he got back. And then he was still in the Army at the time, and he was sent, once he was married, he was sent, dispatched to Fort Riley in Kansas, where he was working as a clerk typist. Jane started this campaign, and I've been actually writing a little piece for the New Yorker about this, about how Jane pretty much convinced him to be a writer as a young man, and it's really a beautiful thing to see, and the Vonnegut family let me see some wonderful letters between from Kurt to Jane at the time, in which he says, "Oh, honey," I'm paraphrasing, by the way, "Oh, honey, I don't think I'm that good. You know, stop saying that I'm like Chekhov. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of embarrassing. You know, oh, honey, I'm really worried that you think I'm going to create the literature of post-war America. I mean, what if I don't? Are you going to still love me?" Literally, he says these things. And Jane's like unwavering in her belief that he should write. So he starts writing. And I love, this is actually an unauthorized photo that I took at the Lilly Library. Sorry. It's the back of, so I'm not violating Kurt Vonnegut's copyright. This is actually public domain. It's a manuscript called Atrocity Story that he wrote. And it's concerns an incident that he experienced while he was a prisoner of war, in which a soldier that he knew was executed for stealing a can of string beans. And as any of you who've read Slaughterhouse-Five know, this is kind of the dark heart of Slaughterhouse-Five. This becomes a really crucial incident in that book. He wrote his first story about it in 1945 in Fort Riley, Kansas, and he wrote it, I love this detail, on the back of the weather report. So it's the teletype here. Probably there wasn't that much paper, right? So he would just use these weather reports to type up his manuscripts, and then he would mail them to Jane. She would fix all the spelling mistakes and errors and stuff, edit them, and package them up to send out. So around that, Kurt finally gets his discharge, and he goes off to University of Chicago to study anthropology. He decides that's what he's going to do because it's kind of like a scientific thing. Around about this time, we wanted to be on this slide, Bernard begins working with Irving Langmuir and Vincent Schaefer at GE Labs, and they are working on a fantastic new idea, which is weather control. And Vincent actually did this experiment. He requisitioned a GE freezer, and many of you know this story, so I'm sorry to repeat it for you, but he requisitions a GE freezer, puts some black velvet in, shines a light on it so he can see it, breathes into it, making a small cloud, and then tries spraying it with a whole variety of things to see what will cause it to precipitate. Because he and Irving Langmuir had developed this theory that clouds need a little boost in order to precipitate. They need some sort of encouragement. They need a nucleus for the water droplets to adhere to. So he's putting all these different things into the freezer. And one day, it's a really hot day. They don't have air conditioning yet. It's, 1946. And he throws a block of dry ice into the freezer to keep it cool. And immediately, the little cloud that he has in there turns into snow crystals. And so he's so excited because he's figured out a way to cause precipitation. And I want to tell you that you can do this. You can repeat this experiment at home. I actually did it when someone sent me, how they send you, Omaha steaks, and they come with some dry ice. And I said to Bob, we're going to cloud seed in the freezer, and we didn't use the black velvet, but we pulled open the freezer and we, put the dry ice and breathed into it, dry ice in, and sure enough, little snowflakes formed. It was like a little miniature snowstorm. It's so gratifying. So do that with any curious children you know. They will love it. So, Bernard, shortly after that, Vincent and Bernard and Irving begin going on these test flights, dropping dry ice into cloud banks, and it works really well. Bernard, on the other hand, and I'm just going to kind of skip through this, but there's more details about this in the book, but Bernard was really convinced that there was a better method, and that they must be able to use some kind of chemical to nucleate the water vapor in the clouds. So he eventually comes upon a chemical that has a very similar crystalline structure to water, and that's silver iodide. And so they're doing these tests on both silver iodide and dry ice, and the results, as you can see in this picture, are really quite dramatic. You would drop this stuff into the clouds, and the snow would just fall right out, or if it was warm enough, it would turn into rain as it was going down to the ground. So in November of 1946, GE issues a press release saying, some scientists at GE now know how to make rain or snow. This was huge, huge news. The media responded with headlines like this, scientist predicts world weather control, right? This was like, and this is how this story was run. I mean, they had thousands of letters coming from all over the world, and one of the most fun parts of this research was sitting in the GE archive reading the letters, which still exist, and some of them are in the Albany papers, Vincent Schaefer papers as well. Everyone in the world immediately wanted GE to solve their weather problems. Ski slopes were like, hey, come and make us some snow. Film shoots were saying, we've got a shoot in December in Buffalo, so if you could keep the snow from falling, that That would be cool. Chile, the government of Chile wrote saying, you know, could you come and like make our deserts bloom? Because we really, you know, have an issue with drought. Everyone had an idea for how this could be used. There's one great story where Bernard is the only one in the lab, and the phone rings, and it's some people in California, and it was at Mount Rainier, it was in Washington. They needed to clear away the overcast clouds in order to find a plane that had crashed on Mount Rainier. And so he's trying to talk to people over the phone and explain to them how to do it, but it, you know, it's a tricky thing to do. So Irving Langmuir, who was a very important person at the GE Research Lab and a Nobel laureate, a serious person, not to be taken lightly, was going around telling the newspapers, and they readily repeated this, that weather control would end up being a more important discovery than the discovery of crushing the atom. So, and meanwhile, this is about the time that Kurt arrives at GE. And what happened was that Kurt, who was kind of trying to finish up his degree at U of Chicago, had his first child, Mark Vonnegut, born in 1947. And Kurt felt very strongly the need to be the family breadwinner. He really felt like he should have a nice, safe, secure job. He'd been working nights in the city newsroom while trying to finish his degree. He just didn't think that was good enough, so he started sending out a whole lot of letters to try to find a job. Bernard recommended him to the GE News Bureau, which is the publicity arm of GE. The GE News Bureau was organized like a newsroom, as you can see from this picture. And I really love this picture. The so-called portable typewriters in the front of the picture, and the guy on the phone, and everyone's in a suit because, you know, newspaper men wore suits to work in those days. And all of those pictures on the back, when you see the picture for real and look at it up close, many of them are actually of Bernard. So Kurt comes to work in this news bureau where his brother is one of the biggest stories. He liked the job. It was a nice, safe job. It had good benefits. The company was known as the Generous Electric Company. It was really going to, you know, provide him the security he wanted to have a family. The first thing he did was Bernard took him shopping for some GE appliances at the employee store. But he had this secret ambition, and Jane was, you know, encouraging him in this, and that was to write. So in the evenings and on the weekends, he would sit down at this little typewriter that they set up at home, and he would crank out stories. And he was cranking out the stories that he thought would appeal to the so-called slick magazines, like the Saturday Evening Post and Collier's, you know, boy meets girl, meet cute at the bus stop, and stuff like that. And it was, you know, it wasn't going so well. He was, on the one hand, you know, this is a picture of Kurt from this period, and he's not the Kurt Vonnegut we think of, the kind of guy in the rumpled suit with the Pall Mall and the quizzical look. He was really doing his best to be a company man, to be a good company man. All he was getting with his writing was rejection after rejection after rejection. And any writer in the world would be so happy to go to the Lilly Library in Bloomington, Indiana, and look through the file labeled rejection letters, because it's just one after the other. And I actually wasn't sure about the legality of showing pictures of these, and I also didn't have the foresight to take pictures of them when I was in Bloomington. So these rejection letters are actually my own rejection letters, which I'm very proud to say are from some of the same highfalutin periodicals that Kurt Vonnegut was rejected from time and time again. And I'm here to tell you that they don't change like that, you know, that New Yorker rejection at the very front. Kurt got that same rejection. Same font, same words, same everything. Like, thank you for submitting. This does not meet our needs at this time. So things were, he's plugging away, and Bernard is plugging away, but things have changed for him a little bit because GE's suddenly nervous, right? Their scientists are out there making rain and making snow. What could possibly happen? The GE lawyers were, you can just imagine them. You can just imagine how the scene must have gone. You know, the GE lawyers were pretty much beside themselves. They really did not want this happening. So they came up with a plan, because of course, when you start talking about making rain, clearing fogs, dissipating fogs, things like possibly steering hurricanes, your number one interest is going to come from the military. So the military was immediately excited about this. So here's a great picture of, there's an admiral and a general, and in the middle is Bernie, and Bernie has a pop gun that he bought for 40 cents downtown Schenectady, because he'd figured out that if he popped this pop gun in the cloud, that too would cause the cloud to make snow. Irving Langmuir is in the foreground. What I really love about the picture is the expression on the guy next to Irving Langmuir, who's just looking into that freezer, and he's like, oh yeah, oh yeah, here's my next big super weapon, bring it. So, you know, this was an interesting thing. It was a kind of win-win situation for the military and GE. They immediately joined up in a project that they gave the secret code name, or not so secret code name, but you have to have a sci-fi like code name if you have a weather control project. So they called themselves Project Cirrus. It was a joint GE Army program, and they started moving into bigger and better test flights, because of course the military could provide things like this B-17 and the pilots to fly it. This B-17, these guys around the underneath the wing are loading it up with dry ice to go on a seeding run. And then GE issued press releases saying, our scientists are not doing any weather control whatsoever. They are not seeding clouds. They are not spraying anything on anything. They are advisors. The government is doing these experiments. And then, you know, Bernie and Vince would get in the plane and like literally shovel the dry ice out the window. But it was all a nice safe wall of military brass between them and the potential lawsuits. It must have been odd for Bernie, who found himself suddenly aboard the very same bomber planes that his brother had, you know, just avoided death from. Here he is in a flight suit, and I love this, you know, Dr. Strangelove, Bernard Vonnegut as Dr. Strangelove, as Flash Gordon, you know, flying a weather flight. So one of the first projects that they decided to go and do, now that they had military backing and military protection, was to try to steer a hurricane, because this was perhaps, you know, one of the most dramatic things that they could do. If they could, you know, what Irving and Vince and Bernie are thinking is, if we can just steer hurricanes away from the shore, you know, that would be really good for people. It would stop damage. And the military is thinking, if we could steer a hurricane, you know, we could really mess with Cuba. So they were all excited about this. So they waited throughout the fall of 1947 for a good hurricane. And when one finally came around, they flew down to Florida. The hurricane had crossed the tip of Florida. And this is the hurricane path, because Wikipedia does this service of, you can download a track of every hurricane that's kind of pulled out of NOAA data that's been logged in the 20th century. So this hurricane from, I believe it was October 1947, it crossed the tip of Florida, and then it was kind of chugging harmlessly out to sea. And then Project Cirrus flew over it and seeded it, and that was at the point where that big elbow at the top is. And so this hurricane, as soon as they seeded it, immediately took a dogleg left and went back to shore and slammed Savannah, knocked out the airport in Charleston, caused, you know, millions of dollars worth of damage, and put people out of their homes. So GE immediately, the Army classified the data, GE flew all the scientists back, hurriedly pulled together a press release, and the GE scientists went out and said, okay, we were really just looking at that hurricane, we were just kind of studying it, you know. So this was an interesting incident, I think, and perhaps the beginning of Bernie's thinking about the fact that you didn't actually have to be trying to make a weapon when you might make one. The South never reacts well to these things. This was referred to in the Southern press as a low Yankee trick. Yeah, I know, I love that. They're still fighting the Civil War. And the mayor of Savannah said if anyone from GE turned up in his town, he'd arrest him. So Bernard was, you know, Bernard, like all the Vonneguts, was a pacifist. He did not like the idea of his invention being used as a weapon. He had hoped to create something of benefit to humanity. But everybody else loved the idea of weather control as a hurricane. There was one general who was going around saying, you know, the first nation to gain control of the air masses will rule the world. So, you know, this cover from Collier's was pretty typical of how people were thinking about it. You know, it was really, you know, going to put in our hands at last the ability to control, for better or for worse, the weather, either for good, the good of humanity, or for ill. And this kind of raised an ethical problem that scientists were already thinking about in the post-atomic age, which is how responsible are scientists for their weapons being used for harm, you know? And this was something that Kurt later said many people around GE discussed at the time, you know, should the atomic scientists have given the government the bomb? Was it the right thing to do? Should they have tried harder to convince the government not to drop it? These were questions that were very much in the air at a place like the GE Research Lab. And it was around about the time that Kurt began to write a new kind of story. And this was a kind of story in which the main character was a scientist who was grappling with the ethical issues raised by his work. His first successful story, sold to Collier's in 1949, was Report on the Barnhouse Effect. This is an illustration from Report on the Barnhouse Effect, but I kind of like it side by side with the weather control piece that talks about his brother's work, because it kind of shows how these two things were happening in the same universe. Report on the Barnhouse Effect concerns a scientist, Professor Barnhouse, who discovers that he can control things that were previously thought to be uncontrollable. He's very excited. He thinks this can be used for the good of humanity, but the military gets involved and they see it as their next big super weapon. They take control of his project. They give it a sci-fi like code name, Project Wishing Well, and they immediately embark on tests to try to make things happen. And Professor Barnhouse has to figure out how to stop them. So this was very interesting. You know, he was Professor Barnhouse. Kurt had found a successful formula. You take the things that he was actually seeing going on at GE, at the research lab, and specifically with his brother sometimes, and you amp them up, and you make them just a little fantastical in order to amp up their ethical implications. So another thing that happened at GE, this is the GE differential analyzer, what we today would call a computer. It's a very sexy picture for those of you who like computers. History, because computers were just glorious things back in those days. They were big, giant machines that you got inside to work on while you were wearing a suit. I can tell you that this is not how it looks at Google today. The GE computer was called OMIBAC, which stood for like ordinal memory inspection and binary counting system or something. Kurt wrote a story about a computer called EpiCac, and this is the illustration from it when it ran in Collier's. And in this story, the computer's really smart, but it's so smart it falls in love with the programmer's object of affection. And here there's like poetry, love poetry, pouring off the tape drive for her. It eventually kills itself in despair by overloading its vacuum tubes. You just gotta love it, right? this is not a very good picture, or this is not a very good picture of a press piece for GE about ultrasonics that Kurt wrote about sound, ultra-high sound waves that were being used in very interesting applications. Right about the time he wrote a press release about ultrasonics, Kurt wrote a story called The UFO Effect about a radio signal that is so blissful and so wonderful sounding that when it's played over the radio, everybody just stops what they're doing. They just like stop their cars on the highway and get out and just lie there blissing out and listening to this sound. So once again, it seems kind of sci-fi, but it's really based on the stuff that he was seeing going on, and it's all aimed at asking the same question: how responsible are scientists, and when are we going to finally start thinking about the implications of these technological advances that we're also excited about? There was a story called Thanosphere about a satellite that was sent up, a manned satellite sent up to keep tabs on the weather and, of course, on Stalin, that ends up finding out that that space is filled with the souls of the dead. And in order to keep the people from finding this out, the military brings down the satellite, killing the man aboard, and the scientist involved has to cover it all up. It ends with him, you know, going to a press conference where he denies. This scientist in this story was named Bernard. Kurt, when he was asked later, you know, why he wrote science fiction, Kurt Vonnegut said there was no avoiding it. The General Electric Company was science fiction. And you kind of see, you know, throughout his life, he felt that what he was writing was social satire, that what he was writing was deeply engaged with the issues of the moment, and he never liked being seen as this kind of trippy, fantastical, you know, space age writer who was writing about aliens and porn stars and weirdness. So, you know, in fact, and this is, I just threw in some more of these because I have an audience here of GE fans, and rummaging around in that fabulous treasure trove in Schenectady, I just kept stumbling upon the early sources of Kurt's stories. So there's the day that a deer managed to get inside the Schenectady works, and the PR guy was called out to come and photograph it before they removed it from the works. This becomes Deer in the Works, which is the first story that Kurt Vonnegut ever sold to Esquire. There's the story of the walking, talking refrigerator that GE had in its sales force that was once even issued a ticket in Cincinnati for whistling at a pretty woman. I kid you not. You can't make this stuff up. This is why you have to be a nonfiction writer, right? Kurt, very cleverly, because he had an instinct for story, he turns this refrigerator into a woman, makes her kind of sexy, and turns the story into a guy who can't relate to real women anymore because he loves his refrigerator so much. It's kind of like that movie that was out recently with Scarlett Johansson as the operating system, right? He was very prescient. There's the poor air conditioning engineer at GE who was so obsessed with model trains that he got written up in GE Monogram, and then he got turned into a Kurt Vonnegut story called With His Hand on the Throttle, in which this guy is so obsessed with model trains that his wife finally buys some model planes and bombs the heck out of his trains. And there's the American state tour of the minister of the newly formed state of Pakistan, Liaquat Ali Khan, who was invited to the U.S. and was taken around, and he was shown great factories and military grounds and the National Cemetery and Columbia University, and he visited with Truman, and he went to see prize cattle, and he sat down with an American, an average American family in an average American home, and of course he eventually ended up in Schenectady at the GE Works, where he stood by while this guy drives rivets into a flywheel. And Liaquat Ali Khan was assassinated in 1951 by a Pashtun nationalist, and it was right about that time that Kurt, who had been at GE during Liaquat's state tour there, wrote The Shah of Bratpur into Player Piano. And The Shah of Bratpur goes around in the same exact grand tour that was given to Liaquat Ali Khan. So finding this little treasure trove of photos at the Truman Library was like finding, you know, the text, the resource that Kurt was, that was running through his head when he wrote that bit. And of course, I'm sure many people in this room are familiar with Association Island, the island where GE would take its promising young men and issue them all a GE monogram t-shirt and, for some reason, a straw boater as they got off the boat, and have, you know, take, have them spend 5 days playing team sports, watching skits, indulging in ceremonies, drinking, and competing in softball and things like that as a kind of team building and networking experience. Kurt skewered this so mercilessly in Player Piano that in later years he actually took credit for the fact that GE closed Association Island down. I don't know if that's true or not. Maybe somebody here knows, but it's funny. I found these photographs in the Lemuel Boulware files at the University of Pennsylvania, and my favorite one was this one, which was the skit from 1948. The skits were always written by Boulware, and they were always skits about how the misguided workers thought that the unions were their protectors, but really they should just do what management wanted. And that's what this skit, you know, is about. And if you've read Player Piano and you know the skit in Player, the scene in which this skit happens, it's this exactly. Like this, you could use this as an illustration in Player Piano, which was fun to find. Probably the most significant story that Kurt found at GE while he was there was the concept of Ice Nine, and he many times told the story about how Ice Nine was actually Irving Langmuir's idea. The story goes that Irving Langmuir was given the task of entertaining H.G. Wells when he came to visit GE. Irving Langmuir didn't really know how to talk to a novelist. He was a famously absent-minded scientist. So he just thought, he's a novelist, so he must like ideas for novels. And so he, you know, thought about it for a while, came up with an idea for a novel, and then said to H.G. Wells, hey, why don't you write a novel about a form of ice that's stable at room temperature? And H.G. Wells was kind of like, nah. But that story was told frequently around GE. You know, there were all the GE stories that were always told about Irving Langmuir, how he stepped in a bucket of safety paint and just kept walking and left, you know, yellow footprints down the hall, how he went to pick up his wife and got so lost in his thoughts that when he arrived and she waved, he just waved and kept driving. If his secretary was replaced by a temp, he wouldn't notice. He'd just call her Barbara all day, and, you know, that would be it. So, you know, there were all these stories that were told at the cocktail parties at GE in those years, and one of them was this story, and Kurt just thought, finders keepers, I really like that idea. And he also liked the idea of a scientist with his head so in the clouds that he never thought about the implications of what he was doing. And so he frequently in his later years said that Felix Honecker in Cat's Cradle was a direct portrait of Irving Langmuir, Bernie's boss. However, I'm going to propose to you that Ice Nine was actually the invention of his brother, Bernard Vonnegut, because the way that Ice Nine is described in Cat's Cradle is as a new way for the molecules in water to stack or lock, you know, and Bernard told Kurt that exact thing. He said, in fact, think of cannonballs on a courthouse lawn. They can be stacked in different ways, and so can the molecules in ice. And so this is how he was describing the way his silver iodide invention worked in clouds. And so Kurt borrows Ice Nine. This is Bernie, by the way, lighting some silver iodide with a generator to cause it to make an aerosolized smoke that could be used to seed clouds. And, you know, he just looks like the great mad scientist here. The difference, of course, between Bernie and Irving Langmuir, perhaps, I don't know as much about Irving Langmuir as I know about Bernie, but Bernie certainly seemed very concerned with what might happen with his inventions. And by the time Kurt left GE, more and more people were making the pilgrimage there to learn how to make rain. This is a senator from New Mexico who was, again, getting the little dog and pony show where they used the pop gun to make a cloud precipitate. Bernie was concerned because all over the western part of the nation, people were spraying massive amounts of silver iodide into the atmosphere and not really paying attention to what was happening because, of course, as soon as it was announced that one could do this, a whole bunch of homespun, we'll make rain for you organizations popped up and the entrepreneurial spirit took control. This is a map that Bernard made of areas in the American West that were under cloud seeding contracts in 1951. So, you know, a good proportion of the nation was being cloud seeded. And what he was saying is, you know, let's stop. Let's take a look at this and think about what's happening here, because it's possible that, you know, we could be causing huge atmospheric changes in the climate. We don't know. We need to study this. And of course, what people said was, oh, don't be silly. Humans couldn't possibly change the climate. So that's pretty much the first half of the book, and I'm going to leave you there because I think we might have some questions from the audience, and I'm eager to hear them.